Dauber 1, tape 5.
This was a test case, and in order to bring the lawsuit, one of the parties had to say that, to challenge my qualification to sit.
Oh, I see.
So it was agreed among the lawyers, one of them would challenge my qualification to sit, and the other lawyer would try to uphold it. Uh-huh. And that's how they got this test case in. I mean, it was a, what we call a friendly suit, really. Uh-huh. What they wanted was establish the fact that I could or could not sit, because if I tried the case, and later the appellate court said that I shouldn't have sat on the case, then we would have wasted a lot of the taxpayers' money and time for all the lawyers to try this case. So that's why we sometimes have these test cases. So they filed this writ in the Court of Appeal to decide whether or not the trial judge, and so the writ is directed against the trial judge. Mm-hmm. And the court would say, you cannot sit on this case, or it's all right for you to sit on this case. Right. So that's why the writ was directed against the trial judge. Uh-huh. That's why I was happened to be the trial judge. So so the title of the case was Central Water Basin versus Wong. Uh-huh. Now, very frequently, cases are brought to test the validity of an official. For example, if a sheriff is holding a prisoner, they might issue a writ directed at the sheriff to show cause why he should not release the prisoner. Mm-hmm. And then the prosecutor or county counsel would then defend the sheriff, indicating why they should not release the prisoner. So this is just one way of bringing a matter into court.
I see. So like, is this case, for example, in the future, this similar type of situation?
It'd be precedent.
Okay.
So from now on, any judge who owns property is not automatically disqualified.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it does have effect on the future?
Oh, yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I see. So you were talking about more on your, try to wrap up the feeling of your whole career and any other things that you would like to add. Basically, you say you were satisfied.
Yes, I'm very grateful I had the experience to serve as a judge, and it's had been a fascinating period of my life to not only try cases involving litigants, but also to see the effects of some of my decisions as they appear on the appellate records. Mm-hmm. Because some of the cases that I've tried as a trial judge were appealed to the higher courts and established precedent in various areas.
Mm-hmm. You have one there too.
This one, yes.
Right,
and then
okay.
there are others.
There are others that also involve, such as...
Well, also establishing laws. Mm-hmm. For example, I think I had one case involving the negligence of title companies. The case involved a man who lost his house because it title company made a mistake, and they recorded his documents in the wrong county. Mm. He lost his home. Mm-hmm. And when he tried to sue the title company, they pointed out the fact that in the contract which he signed with the title company, he excused them from any negligence on their part. Mm-hmm. In other words, the title company had that we should not be responsible for negligence of any of our employees. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, you can't sue us because you signed this document. Mm. So the lawyers for the landowner then challenged the validity of that that clause. Mm-hmm. And I ruled that the clause was invalid because the parties did not have equal bargaining position, and the one who employed the title company did not have the ability to resist the title company's putting this clause in. It was called a contract of adhesion. So later on, the case went up on up to the Court of Appeal, and they upheld my ruling, so that became the law of the state on what we call contracts of adhesion.
Mm-hmm.
So when the parties are of unequal bargaining power and the stronger party takes advantage of the weaker party, that contract can be held invalid.
Mm-hmm. So there's a satisfaction part of being able to establish some sort of law for the benefit of the general public.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess that's what is the most exciting moment of your experiences in this judicial field. You have any?
Well, it's very difficult for me to point to any one case that that has been the most satisfying. I think over the years there have been many cases, and I don't think I could just point at any one that I felt. I think as I look through the annuals of the cases, I suppose over the years there have been many cases. Oh, that brings to mind. I was the president of the Los Angeles County Law Library's Board of Trustees.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I was on the board for 12 or 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was president for about 6 or 8.
Wow.
And when I retired,
mm-hmm.
the library board and the librarian got an IBM printout
mm-hmm.
of all the cases I handled as a Superior Court judge, and presented that to me. And I was very pleased because I had not realized at the time, you know, while you're doing it, you don't realize the import or the impact of what one has been doing all these years.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have that, and I'll show it to you in just a minute.
Oh, great, yeah.
I want
so
to just cut this off. All right, go ahead. No, let's go on.
Yeah, okay. And, that's really neat. Where's the law library, County Law Library?
Oh, County Law Library. Actually, the main branch is at First and Hill. It's on First Street between Hill and Broadway. Right across street from
the. Is this also open for the public?
Oh, yes. No, it's open to the public.
Uh-huh.
It's opened 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And there are actually 9 branches
mm-hmm.
Of the library. We have branches all over the county.
Uh-huh. Would this library also belong to one of the LA public library systems?
No, this is a separate system.
Okay.
No, the county law libraries. The Board of Trustees.
Mm-hmm.
The Board of Trustees runs the county law libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And we are our libraries are supported by filing fees.
Mm.
So every time someone files a lawsuit, $5 out of the filing fee is diverted to the law library.
Oh, I see. So it's self-supported.
It is self-supporting.
The system.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
So. And I think it's fair. The people who use the court system are the ones who pay for the law library. Which seems fair.
Uh-huh. Well, since you were there involving me, this library, would most of the people who use the library are the ones that lawyers and judges? And
law students, lawyers, judges, and members of the general public.
Uh-huh.
It's open to everyone, and it's open not only, I think, the fairly long hours.
Compared to the public library, do you think this law library has better services, or they have better financial support?
Well, I would say the law library has better financial support than the public libraries because of the built-in support through fees.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the public libraries have to compete with all the other agencies and all the other governmental
mm-hmm.
activities.
Mm-hmm.
And libraries like schools can sometimes be left out in the cold.
That's right, yeah. How about each county has its own law library or its own?
No,
Los Angeles?
Each county has its own.
In the whole United States?
No, in California.
Only in California.
Each county. And that's why some of the counties have very poor libraries. They have poor libraries because they're so underfinanced.
Mm-hmm.
They're underfinanced because those particular counties do not have as many lawsuits filed.
Mm-hmm.
See, we're fortunate in Los Angeles County in a way. Mm-hmm. We have many, many lawsuits filed. And that, the lawsuits then bring money into the coffers. And that's why we have a statewide organization of county law libraries, and we're looking for alternative financing. And while it doesn't affect Los Angeles County, we are vitally interested because we'd like to help them secure alternative financing. So they have to go to the Board of Supervisors and ask for alternative financing, and they're on the same position as the public libraries.
Oh, I see. So
it's very difficult to shake loose money.
Only probably in the well-populated area counties that have better
law libraries. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, our library here ships books to some of the smaller counties.
So there is interlibrary also services.
On an informal basis.
Mm-hmm.
On an informal basis.
And the librarians or professional librarians hired by the board?
Yes, by the board.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're able to attract qualified people because we're able to pay. Actually, I believe next to the Library of Congress,
mm-hmm.
ours is the biggest library.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the volume of circulations
Oh, the number of employees is. I can't give you that figure offhand, but it's we have 9 libraries, you know,
okay.
9 branches,
mm-hmm.
and I know that our pay scale. Is equivalent to that of paid by the librarians and Library of Congress and Harvard and Yale law libraries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think ours is either the second or the third.
Mm-hmm.
We're either second after the Library of Congress or we're third after Library of Congress and Harvard. So the Harvard Law School Law Library.
Oh, you mean the law library?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Is probably it's either second or we're second, you know.
Oh, never noticed that there's a law library there. And these librarians probably had to have some sort of
Our librarian is a lawyer.
Oh.
And the previous librarian was also a lawyer.
Mm. And they also holds a library degrees or something?
Oh, yes, they hold library degrees too.
Nice, that's very interesting. So you have a lot of contribution into this field. You have a lot of contribution.
Well, no, actually, I was very interested, and I was glad that I was able to serve on the board.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, I guess probably we should switch to your other activities rather than in judicial area. And so I know that you were in the, you served in the Air Force during the war, too. Would you like to...
Want me to give you warm that up?
Would you like to talk about your experiences during World War II?
All right. During World War II, I was attending the University of California at the time of Pearl Harbor, which was December of 1941.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the class of 1942,
mm-hmm.
and we all received deferments,
mm-hmm.
until graduation.
Mm-hmm.
So after May of 1942, I enlisted in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
That time I was hoping to become an Air Force pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So I signed up in June of 1942, and I was not called till December of 1942.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the redistribution, to the station, for physical examinations and so forth, and because of my need to wear corrective lenses, I was not permitted to be a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative was either be a bombardier or a navigator, and so
mm-hmm.
I decided, well actually I didn't decide, they decided I should become a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, there was a shortage of people who had mathematical backgrounds to qualify for navigation. And so anyone who's had college education with a little a bit of advanced math were automatically put into the in the navigation field, whereas the others then became bombardiers,
mm-hmm.
which did not require the extensive mathematical knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a good number of Asian Air Force personnel who became navigators.
Uh-huh. That's all right. Asians have better...
well, because better mathematical background,
mm-hmm.
and I think a good number of Asians couldn't pass the eyesight.
That's true, yeah.
Qualifications. Yes, you had to have 20/20 vision, you know,
mm-hmm.
without correction.
Mm-hmm. So that's how you got in.
That's how come I got into the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
as a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not until December that I started my navigation training.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated in July of 1943.
Mm-hmm. Where were you training?
I was trained in first at Santa Ana. That was a basic training. And then I went to Mather Field in Sacramento,
mm-hmm.
and took my flight training. So it was approximately 7 months from the time I started my training that I graduated with a commission as second lieutenant. And immediately I was assigned to an Air Force bomber group that was,
mm-hmm.
scheduled to go to England. So we trained for a specific combat duty from graduation. Actually, I had a month vacation, first leave before going. So from August to November,
mm-hmm.
I trained 3 or 4 months with a bomber crew.
Mm-hmm.
This is advanced training where we got our gunnery practice, which we didn't have in navigation school. And we got more sophisticated navigation instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally went overseas in late November,
mm-hmm.
To England.
Mm-hmm.
And we start our combat tour of duty in December.
Mm-hmm.
So between December of 1943 and June of 1944, I completed 30 bombing missions over Europe. And then I completed my bombing missions just 2 or 3 days before D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
But we were all kept in England as reserve, just in case losses,
mm-hmm.
in the invasion would be higher than expected. As it turned out, the losses for airmen,
mm-hmm.
was quite low during the invasion,
mm-hmm.
because by then the German Air Force had been pretty well destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So it was during the period of time from December to June that we had the big air battles in England.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that our crew participated in the first 3 Berlin missions.
Mm-hmm.
We were on that in the month of March. The first Berlin mission, we lost 60 bombers, as I remember. We had was sent out about 500, and so the losses were quite high.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was also on the mission to Aschersleben, the Bulgarian plant in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and there again we lost I think over 60 bombers that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember the shocked look on the faces of it when we first learned we were going to Berlin. It didn't seem to us at the time that we had the fuel capacity to go from England to Berlin and back. It was a good number of miles, and I think we were actually in the air for 10 or 12 hours on that mission.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we knew we didn't have fighter cover the whole way. So as it turned out, our fighters could only escort us within 30 or 40 minutes of Berlin,
mm-hmm.
and they had to turn back. And when they turned back, then the German fighters came in on us. So the last 30 minutes to and from the target, which is a period of about an hour, we had to go in without fighter cover, and that's why we lost so many airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I finished my missions in June, and I returned to United States, and they sent us then to various schools for further training in other fields. So I became a statistical officer, and I was sent to the Harvard School of Business to study statistics, and then I became a Air Force staff officer then.
Mm-hmm. What was your rank after you
started? I came back as a first lieutenant.
Uh-huh.
And I was discharged the following August. An opportunity to stay on and become a captain, but I says no thanks. I'd rather go to law school.
Uh-huh.
So that's when I entered law school.
Uh-huh. Let me think. Do you have several honors and medals?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. For my 30 missions, I think I received the Air Medal with. Three oak leaf clusters. I mean, if you win more than one Air Medal, instead of giving a second Air Medal, they gave an oak leaf cluster. So I had the Air Medal with three oak leaf clusters, and I had the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Mm-hmm.
I also had the European Theater Ribbon with three battle stars, I believe. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So those were the honors, and in terms of getting the honors, I guess when you were there in the field. What was your feeling? Is it just a duty to go? Is there any fears? And
well, I think we had some fears, but we were all young, and I really and optimistic probably. I mean, we knew that some people didn't come back, but I guess we just never thought that it would be, you know, that the casualties list would include us.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause as a matter of fact, it wasn't until I came back that I realized the terrific odds that were against us. 18 of us graduated from Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew everyone quite well because the group that went to the 401st in our particular group,
mm-hmm,
were from the end of the alphabet. So we were from S to Z,
mm-hmm,
alphabetically. And so I knew the 18 navigators who went into this bomber group pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And of the 18, only three of us completed our 30 missions. The other 15 were shot down.
Mm.
They were not all killed, because many of them became prisoners of war, which we found out later. But of the 18 from our navigation class, only three of us finished our missions.
Mm. Was that the total missions, or because you finished 30 missions? And
Well, no, at that time, when we went overseas and arrived in England, the practice was for flyers to fly 25 missions,
mm-hmm,
and then they'd be returned. That would be a tour of duty.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we flew about 10, they raised it to 30.
Was everybody pretty much?
Oh, they're pretty discouraged. You see, at that time, the losses for heavy bombers was 5% losses into occupied territories,
mm-hmm,
and loss per mission was 11% into central Germany. So I mean, you know, to fly 30 missions, at 5%, you know, 5%, 11%, I mean, you know, it's odds are that if you went to central Germany, I mean, it's 1 in 9 that you wouldn't come back. So,
mm-hmm,
and in your occupied territories, it was 1 in 20 that you would not come back.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you finish 30 missions, you pretty well used up your percentages. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you fly with the same pilot all the time?
We had a regular crew, but we didn't all fly together.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes if a navigator was scheduled to fly and another crew became ill, then they'd pull a navigator from the other crew to go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our crew, actually, not all of us finished. We had one mission in which our waist gunner was killed.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not our waste gunner. I mean, he was a subject waste gunner that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the subject waste gunner was killed, and the barbarian, the ball turret gunner was our regular ball turret gunner.
Mm-hmm.
He was wounded very badly. He had a, and he was shot in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And then our radio operator was
mm-hmm.
wounded.
Mm-hmm.
So we had one killed and two wounded that.
Mm-hmm.
On that mission.
Mm-hmm. So, were there Chinese, American in your team?
No. In fact, I was the only Chinese in the bomb group.
Mm-hmm.
So we had trying to think of the number of crews we had. I think we had 18 crews
mm-hmm.
per squadron, and we had four squadrons.
Mm-hmm.
So there's 72 crews. That would be 720 flying personnel.
Uh-huh.
And I was the only Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was the only Chinese in the bomber group.
Mm-hmm. But there were Chinese, American in the Air Force.
Oh yes. But in our particular bomber group, the 401st, I was only Chinese.
Mm-hmm. What type of bomber?
It's a B-17. They call it
a
Flying Fortress. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Was General Doolittle?
Doolittle?
Yeah. No. The Chinese American general.
Oh, Dewey Low?
Yeah,
oh no, Dewey Low was younger.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he was not in the, he was not in World War II,
I don't think,
yeah.
I see. So you didn't know him?
Not while I was in the service, but I met him after the war.
Mm-hmm.
I met him when he was, I think he was going to law school at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was in the service still. Because as I remember, Dewey Low was in the Korean War.
Uh-huh. So you met him after,
mm-hmm.
during that time, or after he
yeah,
was
in the
service?
I think Dewey Low, I'm not sure whether he was in World War II or not,
mm-hmm.
but he may have started his training.
How did you get to know him? Because he was in law?
No, I just happened to meet him. I met him in either Berkeley or Sacramento. This had to be in the late 40s
uh-huh.
or early 50s.
I thought you were in the same mission. So you mentioned General Doolittle.
Oh, yes.
Do you know, were you under his command?
Yes, well, General Doolittle was the, I believe he was one of the generals.
And at that time, were you pretty happy that you had the chance to fly? Or, you know, when you signed up, you signed up for Air Force? Or
that's right.
And so you want to be a pilot, and you
mm-hmm.
cannot.
Well, as a matter of fact, early in the war, I tried to get into the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, they would not accept Asians in the Navy for jobs other than to be working in the kitchen and doing menial jobs.
Mm-hmm.
For
college graduate, you probably just feel
that. Well, I tried to get in. I signed up for a Navy officer's training, and they told me that I could not qualify because physical conditions. Well, it was silly because I went to the Air Force and they accepted me.
Well, that was the reason. They don't accept Asian Americans, or is there any other reasons?
No, they there was a policy against blacks or Asians in the Navy. I mean, this was early in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose Navy?
What's that?
Why were you interested in
well,
Navy?
Well, it so happened that I was in the I was in business administration,
mm-hmm.
and the Navy came to recruit people in business administration to be quartermaster, to be to receive commissions in the supply, and it seemed to me that that'd be a good opportunity to put my education to use. So I tried to sign up for the Navy, and they rejected us. And then I thought, oh well, I'd like to try the Army then. So I went to the Army Air Force.
Oh, I see. Army Air Force.
Yes, this was before we had a separate branch.
Oh, I see.
During World War II, the Army had its own Air Force, and the Navy had its own Air Force.
Oh, I see. So, I wrote here, you have some distinguished your unit citation.
Oh, yes, yes. Our bomber group, the 401st, received two unit citations. One was on a mission to Leipzig, when our division led the whole First Division Air Force on this bombing raid, and our commanding general was